This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Snarled traffic, potentially for months. That is the warning from state transportation officials today about I-93 after a truck hit and then got stuck under a bridge near Exit 24 in Medford. The accident occurred yesterday. With traffic at or nearing pre-pandemic levels, why months and what does that mean for those hitting the roads? Well, with us to talk more about it is Dan McNichol. He's an infrastructure advocate and former chief spokesperson for the Big Dig. Dan, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Hi, Tiziana. Thanks for having me.
So I got to ask you, you're kind of an insider guy on highways and infrastructure. What was your reaction when you heard about the crash?
You know, it just brought me right back to 2010, if you can believe it, 11 years ago, almost to the day where milling machines on the highway that were to fix the road in Medford, exactly where this accident happened, ground down the bridge to nothing, and they were looking at the abyss below them. They shut down the interstate right at the height of summer traffic. It looks like a replay of something that already happened, and it's going to keep happening because the infrastructure is so fragile.
All right, so I want to get to both parts of that, and I'll ask you, since we're right in the thick of it now, trying to figure out what this is going to mean, how bad was that? How long did it take to get everything back to quote-unquote normal in 2010?
Well, that's a good point. It took a long time. It took all summer into the fall. But this is one bridge, and it's not replacing an entire bridge, but this is a fragile and very weird interchange. It's like an elevated rotary hovering above a most busy interstate. 93 is one of the busier interstates in the entire country. And it's complicated because up above, it's not a local road like a lot of these roads are often that pass over the interstate. It's a major interchange, and it's going to involve a lot of work in special ordering, designing. It's going to take at least as long as I think they're saying, which is a month or two.
Okay, so State Highway Administrator Jonathan Gulliver told our colleagues at Morning Edition a little bit about what it takes to do a repair like this. Here he is.
It's a tedious process. We're going to systematically move across the area that is damaged, so it's going to take some time, and we're going to have to be moving our setup along as we do it, which means traffic shifts are going to happen throughout the day.
So that sounds kind of nightmarish under the best of circumstances. You know, on the residential and construction side, we know we're not under the best of circumstances, that it's harder to get supplies, things are more expensive, labor is short. Should we expect the same kinds of complications for a highway repair like this at this point, Dan?
You know, the optimist in me says maybe there's a steel girder, some beam that can be used that's local. Maybe it's on a construction site and it's going to go up, but they can take it from that site because this is a public safety emergency. That's the best case scenario locally, that there's some beam nearby. The worst case scenario is the beam has to be fabricated. And the Big Dig drew a lot of its fabricated steel for its roof girders, which look very similar to this girder that was struck, from 400 miles away in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, from a high steel structure company. That's the name of the company. But it's not going to be easy because this is probably going to have to be steel. They're not going to be able to retrofit it with a concrete, precast concrete girder. It's going to have to come from a fabrication plant.
So that's bad news. And as I hear you say it, I think about what you said a minute ago about this is a bigger infrastructure problem. And I guess for the uninitiated among us, is this so bad? Okay, so pretend this were like the most state-of-the-art, modern, brand-new highway. This accident happens. Would the repair profile be different? Is there something that has to do with the aging of the infrastructure that makes this so bad? Or is this just a bad accident and it would be tough to fix no matter what?
Well, it's a mess no matter what, Tiziana. And that's an excellent question you raised. This is complicated by the fragility of the interchange, the Roosevelt Circle there. That elevated road is so intertwined and connected to the interstate below at 93 and the local roads all around it, all around the Fells there. And this is going to make the repair that much more difficult. If it were a brand new structure, it probably would have been higher. Maybe the trucker would have gotten past and under this bridge without a problem. These older bridges tend to be a little lower than they should be. And the idea of striking something that's made out of concrete, you know, it could be a whole different accident scene. This steel girder, very strong, but once damaged, it's going to be really difficult to find just the right replacement for it. Modern construction tends to be a little bit more modular and easier to repair, to build, than these older structures. This thing is 60 plus years old. So it's well beyond its life. It's fragile because it's old, rusted, you know, all the salt and all the stories that we know here in New England. But it's also complicated because I-93 is one of the busiest roads in the country.
So I understand, you know, shoulda, woulda, coulda, but I'm still going to ask you, is there something that was on the table to do that we should have done sometime in the last, I don't know, pick your decades, 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, that we didn't do, and if we'd done it, we wouldn't be in this situation?
That is the question. And with trying to, I'm biting my lip because there's so much to say about that, but in short, we'd be a lot better off if we could all depend on another mode of infrastructure, another mode of transportation. So if we had faster trains, I'm not even saying high speed, but if we had a more competent, more comprehensive commuter rail system, this would be a lot less of a burden for a lot more people. But it's going to be a horrific burden because COVID, because schedules are not what they were. Supply chains, like you mentioned, are going to be a little bit challenged, to say the least. And without other modes of transportation, without other ways to get around, it's kind of foolery to think that, oh, just don't use I-93. Well, imagine the burden that's going to put on Medford and Arlington and Cambridge and Melrose. All those small towns are going to get inundated with local traffic that should be on the interstate.
And will that have wear and tear on the local infrastructure that's going to cost those cities and towns later?
Oh, God, yeah. I mean, these 80,000-pound trucks, one truck passing over a bridge is the equivalent of 35,000 regular sedans, small vehicles, SUVs crossing over that same bridge. These heavy loads that are going to be taken off the interstate system because they're going to find other ways are going to be snaking through. Most of the trucking will have to find another route because it's just not efficient for a large truck to maneuver through neighborhoods. But the burden is going to be real. It's going to, I would say as a father, the biggest concern I have is all this traffic, all this road rage, all these heavy loads, commercial loads going through neighborhoods that they're not designed to handle. And that's the real tragedy here, is that the main route is not working. The artery is shut down for the most part. I know we're down to two lanes, not four, but you're going to see a lot of heavy traffic, both in volume and in weight, going through the local neighborhoods.
All right, Dan, that is eye-opening. That's Dan McNichol, an infrastructure advocate and former chief spokesperson for the Big Dig. Appreciate your time.
Oh, thank you.
So Dan's given us that glimpse. Let's step back now and talk a little bit more about where this incident fits in the larger transportation picture. Jim Aloisi is the former Massachusetts Secretary of Transportation, a board member of the group Transit Matters. Jim, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me back.
So let me just ask you your reactions to what we just heard from Dan as we start out.
Well, you asked the question of the day, Tatiana, which is there something we should have been doing that might have made the situation a little less severe? And of course, Dan began to answer it. Right? The answer is yes, of course. Right? I mean, just 2 years ago, in 2019, the Massachusetts Department of Transportation issued a report on traffic congestion in Metro Boston. And this very stretch of road was designated among the top five most severe occurrences of congestion then, right? So it should be no surprise that we have a big problem now, exacerbated by this incident. And as Dan pointed out, it would be great if we had more frequent all-day faster commuter rail services so people would have a viable alternative to get to and from their jobs or other destinations, right? Now, we can still do some things in the short term, right? I mean, for example, the MBTA could offer a combined commuter rail Charlie card combo ticket that would offer people who took commuter rail a free transfer to subway or bus once they entered the city. I would recommend that the T think about doing that, as well as add some capacity.
Wait, before you go on, Jim, let me just ask you, on something like that, is that the kind of policy decision that can be made quickly?
In a nanosecond. Okay. Yeah. And then, you know, add capacity on the Lowell and Haverhill lines. I mean, those things take a little bit of extra effort, but that's exactly the kind of thing we should be doing. It's perfectly safe to be riding transit. The federal law requires everyone be masked. You don't spend as much time on transit as you do in a grocery store typically. There's nothing inherently unsafe about it. It ought to be a mode that people can feel comfortable using. And I think we could use this opportunity and take this not as a setback, but as an opportunity to think about how we can creatively get more people to take more sustainable forms of mobility. Because this has happened in the past in other ways and other places. It will happen again. And we shouldn't be unprepared every time it happens, as we find ourselves unprepared again today.
So it's not lost on any of us, I think, Jim, that this is happening as people are beginning to go back to work. There are a lot of question marks about that. I'm sure you're aware of the Back to Work Report commissioned by the governor. Concerns that more people will actually hit the road as they come back to work. Then we know that actually fatalities, people were taking more chances on the roads even during the pandemic. According to data from the MassDOT database in 2019 and 2020, we had relatively the same number of fatalities on the roads, 324 and 326, even though traffic was different. So are there sort of concentric circles of danger as we take this congested road? And how do we think about that?
Well, Massachusetts has a very dangerous addiction, and the addiction is to automobility. And the biggest pusher, the biggest supplier to enable this addiction is the state. And what we need to do is have a public policy in Massachusetts that says, look, we're going to improve people's overall quality of life by offering them more viable, more sustainable forms of transportation. And we're going to be prepared to deal with these kind of emergency situations by having a system that's responsive, that's able to respond to it quickly and with some agility, right? That's what we need to be doing. We can't be put in a position where we always assume the worst and then we plan our policies assuming the worst. We have to have policies that respond to the moment. And the moment right now in the 21st century really, I think, is getting more people to think differently about their commute, about their journey generally. And I think, you know, there's been a lot of discussion over the past couple of years about improving commuter rail and transforming it into a regional rail system that offers people more frequent service all day long. That service change in terms of frequency is another way of responding to the more flexible work hours that we see emerging as part of the post-pandemic Metro Boston region reality. That's what we need to be doing. We could be doing it in real time. As I said earlier, there are things you can do in the short term. We can encourage more people by making it easier for them to afford a commuter rail pass and giving them a little incentive. And then we can begin to put some real effort, and that means money and resources, into providing people with those alternatives to driving. Not everyone is going to take that opportunity, and we don't want everybody to do it because the system couldn't handle it. But we want enough people to have the opportunity that when situations like this happen, we don't have to worry about the outcomes the way we do today.
All right. That is Jim Aloisi, former Massachusetts Secretary of Transportation and board member of the group Transit Matters. As always, thanks, Jim.
Thanks a lot.
It is time to ask the doctors. Earlier today, Dr. Anthony Fauci testified before a U.S. Senate committee on the nation's COVID-19 response.
Right now, we are doing studies to determine whether or not we will need boosters to increase the durability of protection. We don't want people to believe that when you're talking about boosters, that means that the vaccines are not effective. They are highly effective. We're talking about the durability of that.
So no boosters for now. The Delta variant now constitutes more than 80% of new cases, new mask mandates out in Los Angeles, an uptick in cases here at home with a seeming breakthrough hotspot in Provincetown. But deaths remain low, and that's important. And Boston University is mandating a vaccine for faculty, staff, and students. And we should note that Boston University holds the license for WBUR. Lots to think about. We have questions. We know you do, too. So the number, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. With us this week, Dr. Davidson Hamer, infectious diseases physician at Boston Medical Center and a professor of infectious diseases and medicine at the Boston University School of Medicine. And Dr. Gabriela Andujar-Vazquez, an infectious disease physician, associate hospital epidemiologist and medical director of the COVID-19 vaccination program at Tufts Medical Center. Dr. Hamer, welcome back.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be back.
And Dr. Andujar-Vazquez, welcome back to you too.
Thank you.
So actually, I'm going to turn to you, Dr. Andujar-Vazquez, for your reactions right at the top to the uptick in cases in Massachusetts. We've got a high vaccination rate, but our positivity test rate is now back above 1%. What's your reaction to that?
Right. I think it's important to know, and I think you mentioned this, that we did have, unfortunately, increasing in cases in P-Town, but and some of them, it seems most of them had been fully vaccinated individuals. But to my knowledge, it seems that a lot of these cases have been mild to asymptomatic, which means that the vaccine is working. Even though we had this unfortunate outbreak there, you know, it seems that we're still able to control some of it by having some of the individuals in that area vaccinated and not being severely ill.
And Dr. Hamer, how about you? Are you concerned? And if not, what would be a cause for concern?
I'm increasingly concerned. I mean, I think, you know, as you said, that Delta, I guess, across the country accounts for about 80% of positive samples right now. And Delta is much more contagious. And increasingly, I'm hearing about Delta leading to a much higher viral load in the sort of nasopharynx, and that could facilitate transmission and lead to vaccine breakthroughs. As Dr. Andujar-Vazquez said, you know, we haven't yet seen an increase in hospitalizations and certainly not deaths. Those are good signs, and that may be hopefully a protective effect because we have a good level of vaccine coverage in the Commonwealth.
So I'm there's like 10 thoughts crashing into my head at once because we are in this moment, and it picks up on both of what the things you both just said. We are supposed to be at a point where if we have lots of people vaccinated, we are protected against the worst of things. And we are supposed to be able to manage sort of everyday life with some basic precautions. It feels like the conversation right now is more afraid than that the messaging is maybe that's not the case. And yet we also know breakthrough cases at the Commonwealth level are 0.1%. We know there are battles back and forth about whether mask wearing is necessary. So are we over messaging the danger of Delta for those who are vaccinated? Or am I wrong to even ask that question? I mean, this feels kind of like a mess, Dr. Andujar-Vazquez.
I think that it's hard to predict with this virus, and whoever thinks that they know everything about this virus, you're welcome. I would never dare to say that. I think that as of now, fully vaccinated individuals seem to be very well protected against the Delta variant, and even if they, after fully being vaccinated, do get infected, they seem to be the majority do okay, which is important, I guess, in order to curb the surge of this Delta variant, as Dr. Hamer pointed out, that it's more virulent and easier to propagate, right? So I think that we still have to keep on saying the message that we do need to continue to vaccinate individuals that are eligible in order to try to control this particular variant that it's now basically 80% or more of the nation.
1-800-423-8255 to ask your coronavirus questions. I will go to the phones in just a minute. We do have callers in. But Dr. Hamer, I want to get your reaction to the same sort of garbled question that I asked a minute ago about how messy the situation we are in right now is and what the public health messaging ought to be.
I think it's a challenging time. We're still learning about Delta, and it does appear that the three vaccines we have in the U.S. are active against it based on sort of, you know, studies of antibodies and how well they control it, and then some population-based effectiveness studies. But that said, you know, this is a much more contagious strain, and the way it's starting to ravage certain parts of the world, mostly unvaccinated, and then even hitting hard places that have had a pretty good level of vaccination, although generally the sectors that are being hit hard are populations that have not had the vaccine at all or incomplete vaccination. I think we need to keep a close eye on it. I mean, the fact that the state, you know, the numbers across the state have been, the average for the last week has increased relative to weeks before that. The proportion positive has increased, not a lot yet, but we need to keep a close eye on this because it may require our being more intensive with our control and prevention measures.
All right, let's go to the phones again. 800-423-8255 to ask your questions of Drs. Hamer and Andujar Vazquez. We've got Paul on the line in Marshfield. Paul, go ahead.
Yes, thank you. I'm a fully vaccinated, thank you for your time, doctors. I'm a fully vaccinated person, and, you know, I got the Johnson & Johnson in April. So I understand the things. So how should I act as a fully vaccinated person? Should I wear a mask, like when I go in the supermarket or if a place or avoid places that are crowded? The other part of that question is, if there are boosters in the future, can I get an mRNA like a Pfizer or something like that?
Okay, Dr. Andujar Vazquez, what can you do for Paul?
Sure, Paul. So I think that to answer the first part of your question is that people that are fully vaccinated, because the vaccine is very effective against all variants, including Delta variants, you should be following, you know, the CDC and state guidelines, which is that you don't need to wear a mask indoors if you're fully vaccinated. Now, again, we go back to the level of comfort of each individual, and if it makes you feel safer to wear that mask when you go to the grocery store, it is okay. It's not harmful, right? So, again, I always encourage people that when in doubt and if it makes you feel anxious, you can wear that mask, but that fully vaccinated patients should feel protected. To the second part of your question, which was, remind me, Tiziana, what was the second part?
An mRNA booster a J&J shot.
Sure. I think that we don't have enough data on interchangeability, what we call interchangeability on COVID-19 vaccine. It seems to be okay, safe based on studies that have been done outside the U.S. But if there were to be a booster, I can imagine that it will be around the same vaccine type that you had initially. That's what I predict it would happen. But it's hard to tell now because right now we don't need a booster. We're protected if we're fully vaccinated.
All right, let's grab another call. 800-423-8255. We have Amanda on the line in Westboro. Amanda.
Hi, doctors. I want to start by saying thank you. I drive home from work every day at this time, and it's always helpful to hear these conversations, so thank you. My question is about the sensitivity of PCR tests. I'm wondering if one of you could speak to the possibility that breakthroughs are showing it's positive, but it's a matter of the PCR test being so incredibly sensitive to, you know, minute particles from the virus. That's my statement of it, but if you could speak to that, I would appreciate it.
Dr. Hamer, do you understand the question?
Yes, I think so. Thanks, Amanda. Important question. I think that so you know, the PCR that we use to test samples from the nasopharynx and other parts of the body, but primarily from the nose, are very sensitive. And most labs have a cutoff point that they consider if it's you know at that level or below, because they use what's called cycle threshold, then they consider it a positive. And if it's sort of on the high side, just barely positive, then it may be. You know, the question is it transmissible? Is it live virus? I mean, there's a lot of questions about sort of how meaningful that is. I've been hearing anecdotes just in the last week that at least with vaccine breakthroughs with the alpha variant B117, what it used to be called, most many people had very mild infections. They had high cycle threshold, so apparently a low viral load, and then, you know, very few symptoms, and it sort of fizzled out after a few days. But then recently I've been hearing more about breakthroughs that we think are Delta, not yet confirmed, where the cycle threshold or the viral load is much higher. It's, you know, in the 15 to 20 range rather than 35 to 40. And that is virus that could easily be transmitted. And then more of these people are having symptoms too. I mean, it's a little, you know, this is anecdotal based on small numbers of cases. But it suggests if a higher amount of virus is being detected, that's a worrisome situation. Whereas, as you noted, if it's so sensitive and it's just barely detecting it, that may not be much to worry about.
So I just want to clarify before we go to the next call then. Does it remain the case that we argue, however, that you get less sick if you have been vaccinated?
Yes, so far that's correct, but I think that we need to have a better body of evidence from the Delta variant versus the Alpha variant to see whether is there a higher viral load in people that become infected with this? Does it go up faster? And if so, does it lead to an increased risk of symptoms relative to Alpha or some of the viruses like the Wuhan type virus that we had originally?
All right, let's go back to the phones, 800-423-8255. We've got Michelle on the line in West Yarmouth. Michelle, go ahead.
Hi, and thank you so much for this program, and thanks, doctors, for your time. I really look forward to it every week. My question is about long COVID in vaccinated patients who have had maybe a mild breakthrough case of COVID, presumably Delta variant. Do we know anything about that yet? Is it too soon? And what are the markers? When will we know, and what will we know? What are you looking for with that long COVID?
Dr. Andu, thank you for that question, Michelle. Dr. Andu Harvazquez.
Thank you. It's a great question. The short answer is we don't know yet, right? Because we've been fully vaccinated for a short period of time. I would say the earliest, 6 months or so. Well, clinical trials longer, but it seems there seems to be some evidence that even when you're fully vaccinated, you get infected with COVID-19 after being fully vaccinated, you have mild symptoms or maybe asymptomatic, which are the majority of the cases, that there seems to be less of that long-term effects. So it seems to protect even when you get infected with fully vaccination, but we have more to come on that. It's promising, but I can't say that it's absolutely no one will get long COVID if they're fully vaccinated and get infected after, but it's looking good.
And Dr. Andu Harvazquez, I'll stay with you for a second. As long as we're talking about research on breakthrough cases, are you more okay, so you have one person with the same level of Delta illness and a vaccinated person who also has the Delta variant. Is there a difference in your level of contagion to other people? I don't even know if that's a good question, but I think it is.
No, it's good. At a baseline, the patients that are fully vaccinated that have breakthrough infections, interestingly, like Dr. Heyman pointed out, I think he did mentioned that they tend to have a less viral load in their nose, right? They tend to have less of that virus, which leads us to believe that they seem to be maybe less contagious to other people fully vaccinated because they don't have a lot of it in their nasopharynx. But there's still a lot of research ongoing on that. And then, because of that, we usually sequence to look for variants when there's a lot of virus, right? We need a lot of virus to sequence that variant. And when we are fully vaccinated and then have COVID, we have majority of the people, at least I've seen, have a low viral load, right? That makes it a little bit more complicated for the state to sequence. So, I think we have still a lot of data to collect on fully vaccinated and unvaccinated Delta variant and how they behave. But it is looking like, when you are fully vaccinated, you seem to be less contagious, but it's not absolute, right? You still are probably able to, but maybe not as much as someone that's unvaccinated and has a lot of virus in their nose.
Okay, before I go back to the phones, I'm going to turn back over to you for a minute, Dr. Hamer. I mentioned earlier, you know, you're at BU. I mentioned earlier BU holds the broadcast license for WBUR. That doesn't impact our editorial decisions, but I do want to ask you, BU is now joining other schools in the area to mandate vaccines for faculty and staff by September 2nd, or potentially be placed on leave. We're hearing a lot of questions about the efficacy of vaccines against Delta, just a lot we don't know. What is the thinking here from BU on mandating for faculty and staff?
I think, you know, we started out with a volunteer program trying to get faculty and staff to submit their proof of vaccination or a plan that they would be vaccinated by August or September 1st. And that's moved very slowly. The BU plans to fully reopen in September with, you know, populated offices, you know, fully populated classrooms, although we will have an indoor mask mandate regardless of vaccination status. As a precaution, I think it proved to be challenging to get people to submit their paperwork. We think a higher proportion of faculty and staff have been vaccinated than have acknowledged that so far. But there's been a sort of a concern that if we don't have enough coverage and we start opening up classrooms and having in-person meetings and so forth, that there could be a risk of transmission if there's, you know, enough of an unvaccinated population within on the campus. And, you know, many other universities, as you've noted, have followed the same route. It's not, you know, there's some level of discomfort forcing people to do something, although there clearly are precedents with other vaccines. But that said, you know, I think it is the right thing to do right now.
Okay, let's go back to the phones. 800-423-8255. Herbert's on the line in Carver. Herbert, go ahead.
Yes, hi. This is Herbert. Want to keep it quick. I'm wearing a mask. I'm fully vaccinated with the Pfizer vaccine, and I wear the blue medical masks, and mostly because my wife is recovering at home from surgery, and I don't want to bring something home. But the main question is when you're wearing one of the disposable masks, it doesn't seem like people talk about that you're actually going to be actually picking up if someone has the virus. The mask itself is going to get contaminated with droplets, and should we be just disposing of it every time we use it? We go out for the day, throw it away, and start a new one.
Dr. Andhuhar Fazkas, that's a really interesting question.
Yeah, so it's tricky with this mask, you know, it depends on which one, but you're absolutely right. A lot of those disposable masks are meant to be disposable, right? You're done with that mask and you throw it out because the idea is, like you said, that, you know, it's sort of a trap, right, for those droplets to not go into your nose and mouth. We always advise that when you touch your mask that you perform hand hygiene. And then when you remove that mask, you also perform hand hygiene. If it's disposable and you're able to dispose of it after you're using it, then do so, because it's probably the safest thing to do. And then sometimes if it's not disposable, but it's, for example, a cloth mask, you know, when you take it out off at the end of the day, let's say, you should be cleaning that every day, you know, every time you use it, because you not only are trapping those droplets from the outside, right, from other people, but also your own germs, right? So you should be cleaning it as regularly as possible, so you avoid contamination. But always hand hygiene, and when in doubt, you just perform hand hygiene and you can't contaminate yourself.
All right, let's grab one more quick one. We've got Trish on the line in Middleton. Trish, go ahead.
Thank you. I understand from so many of your callers and that if you're fully vaccinated, they're saying you don't need a mask, but I don't feel like they're addressing the issue of young children. And as a grandparent of two kids who are way too young to be vaccinated, aren't they exposing people, especially kids, to COVID if they're not wearing a mask and they do end up being carriers or have no symptoms but do have the virus?
Dr. Hamer.
So, Trish, thanks. That's a great question and a real challenge for families that have younger children. So we're all sort of anxiously waiting for some of the studies to be finished so that we can have approval for pediatric vaccination, at least below the age of 12. You know, I think that you're right. Young children, if they're not wearing a mask and they're out in public places interacting with other children or adults, you know, they have a risk of becoming infected. More often than not, they're going to have a very mild illness or no illness at all, but they still can shed virus and potentially transmit to other children or adults. And so, you know, I think that the guidance, at least for the time being, is for children to wear masks, you know, if they're in places, especially visiting relatives that either haven't been vaccinated or might be very vulnerable. It's a difficult challenge, though, because to do that, it really, you know, if your parents have been vaccinated, but the children have been vaccinated, parents may want to choose to wear a mask just really to be a role model for their children when they're out in public with other families or in public places. I think, you know, sorry, anyways, yeah, that's probably sufficient for an answer. Sorry.
I'm sorry. Thank you, though. I appreciate it. And listen, callers, if we didn't get to you this time, you know we're going to do it again. So keep calling on Tuesday for our Ask the Doctors. Dr. Davidson Hamer there. Thank you. Infectious disease physician at Boston Medical Center and a professor of infectious diseases and medicine at Boston University School of Medicine. And Dr. Gabriela Andujar-Vasquez, infectious disease physician, associate hospital epidemiologist and medical director of the COVID-19 vaccine program at Tufts Medical Center. Thank you to both of you.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. Have a good day.
We'll be back. When a Pulitzer Prize and a McCarthy Genius Award and transformative scholarship are not enough to obtain job security, all academics should be concerned. That's a line written by our next guest, Wellesley Professor Kelly Carter Jackson, about the saga between Nicole Hannah-Jones and the University of North Carolina. Carter Jackson's essay titled, I Am a Black Woman in Academia, Nicole Hannah-Jones's tenure saga isn't unique, can be found on WBUR's Cognoscenti page. And she joins us now to talk about her own experiences as a black woman who's also made a name for herself in the world of academia. Professor Carter Jackson, always good to have you. Welcome back.
Yeah, thanks for having me back. Happy to be here.
So I really want to focus on you, but I do think we should just quickly do a reminder of Hannah-Jones' situation. As you said, she was a Pulitzer Prize winner, a MacArthur Genius Award winner, highly recommended by colleagues and peers, but the first time around, not offered tenure by UNC. So just quickly remind us what happened there.
It's complicated. So basically, they denied her tenure by not taking up her case. So they kept delaying and delaying when they would agree to meet to vote on her case. But essentially, that delay was a denial. And it's an unusual denial because, for one, no one had been denied that position before. But also, she was the first African-American African-American woman to be denied that position as well. And she'd also been voted on unanimously by her colleagues and peers. It got shut down at the highest levels.
Okay. And then later they changed, they offered her tenure, but she said, no, thank you.
They did. They reversed course, mostly, I'm going to say, due to public outcry. Basically, there were several campaigns that were going on in her defense. And they wound up reversing course, holding a meeting, holding a vote, giving her tenure. And she essentially said, thanks, but no thanks. I've already been offered a job and I've taken it at my alma mater, Howard University. So I'm really happy that she's going to be at Howard. But it was, I mean, this has been a very ongoing debate, not just about Nicole Hannah-Jones, but I think academia in general and how politicized it's become. It's been a hot button issue for a long time now.
And it seems like you felt this in your gut.
Oh my gosh. Like, I mean, so my colleagues and I, we've been talking about this really since Cornel West got denied at Harvard. But every time there are major denials, you know, everyone is sort of talking about, have you heard? Did you hear? Because scholars of color, you know, the sort of the rule of thumb is that you have to work twice as hard to be just as good. So oftentimes when scholars of color come up for tenure, their CVs are impeccable. Their awards, their books, everything that they have done has really gone above and beyond the standard for what is required. So when there is denial, it's just gut-wrenching because it feels as though there's very little you can do to be accepted for merit.
So I want to underscore the kind of the magnitude of the problem. You cited some Staggering statistics in your piece. So 2019, North Carolina State University, 643 tenured full professors, 9 black women. Duke University, 1,007 tenured full professors, 8 black women. Penn State, 1,190 tenured full professors, 5 black women. You went up for tenure. Was it terrifying based on those numbers? And did you feel like you had to triple proof?
A little. I have, you know, it's funny because I have done a lot. I have, I mean, not to toot my own horn, but I have done a lot, but I still felt like I had a little bit of anxiety because I write on violence. You know, my book Force and Freedom is about Black abolitionists and the politics of violence. And so I'm always worried, or at least at the time I was worried, that my book could have been maligned simply because no one liked my topic or they thought my topic was too, you know, controversial. So there's always that sort of lingering in the back. I'm glad that Wellesley did not do that, that I do have tenure and that feels very good. But I know exactly what it's like to be in that position where you feel vulnerable. I also know what it's like to, as I talked about in the article, be at a college or a university where you feel completely undervalued and yet also sort of the poster child for diversity and inclusion. And it feels very underhanded.
So, you know, I've been thinking as I read your piece about intersectionality, that, you know, that big word that we use to talk about the compounding factors of identity. I've worked at 3 universities. I was a professor of the practice, so not tenure track, at one of them. And I regularly saw junior faculty women, women trying to get tenure, worried about having kids, worried about having mentorship, et cetera. And I wonder then about the dual impact for women of color when there's already a burden for a woman to try to tenure and how to think about that.
Oh, that's, I mean, again, that's another really big decision, you know. And full disclosure, when I went on the job market, I was pregnant both times and very, very pregnant for my job interview at Wellesley College. I was like 9 months pregnant. I was like 3 weeks from my due date. And when I had interviewed for a job at Hunter College, a previous university I was at, I was about 7 months pregnant. So very visibly pregnant. And I was terrified. I think when I interviewed for Wellesley, I was more terrified I might go into labor. But I was definitely terrified that this would be a blackball against me and that they would not want to hire someone who would immediately need maternity leave or immediately need certain assistance, because I did. And it's hard to have children in academia. It's hard to plan children around tenure, around publications. And I think because so many of us are entering the field in our mid-30s or later in our lives, these are our prime childbearing years. And so it becomes difficult to say to someone, well, you should have your kids in your 20s when you're not really quite that stable. But when you get to your 30s and you are more financially stable, people still wish you would postpone or just not have children at all in order to keep you in the classroom or to keep you publishing or to keep you active within the field.
So are there networks of support? Do women show up for other women and support them during this process? And I wonder, are white women showing up for black women and women of color who are trying to tenure?
Oh, man, those are two really great questions. Yes and no. So I think that oftentimes women struggle and there is some solidarity among other women. But I've interviewed for jobs where there was no, essentially no maternity leave that you had to, they wanted you to teach additional classes to make up for the classes that you missed when you were gone. And I said, well, that sounds really unfair. That sounds like, you know, you're sort of getting penalized for having a baby. And one of the women on the committee said, no, it's not. I did it. No, it's not. And I was like, oh, I clearly won't get support from you on this. So, I mean, in some ways, some women feel like they have fought that fight. You're going to have to fight it too. There are other women, and I would say the majority of women want to help and support other women and make the road easier for them and make the road, you know, easier to navigate for them. But I think that there's still a lot further we have to go when it comes to things like maternity. And especially the pandemic has really laid bare how necessary that is, because many of us have been at home with our children. You've probably heard them in the background when I was giving some sort of interview. It's really, really difficult. And I'll say, when it comes to women of color and white women, those tensions are very much still there. I mean, you see this in every field. There was a big story on ESPN in the sports journalism world about who gets positions and who gets denied. But I think that competitive nature is very much a part of academia as well. So you will absolutely have white women who are allies, who are mentors, who are helpful. And I've had that in my life. But I've also had white women who have undermined me and undercut me and fought for positions to make sure that I would be cut out, or to make sure that they would have more of a share, not just a fair share, but more of a share at the table. And it's really painful, because trying to let everybody know that, hey, we're all trying to do good work, we're all trying to be successful, the sun is big enough to shine on all of us, is sometimes a difficult concept for people to get, because so much about academia grooms you for competitiveness.
Professor Carter Jackson, I'm going to play a quick cut of Nicole Hannah-Jones from an appearance on CNN's New Day earlier this month.
The burden to change systems cannot always be on the people who are being excluded from those systems. The people who created this crisis, this situation at the University of North Carolina, are the people who have the power to change what is happening there.
So in our remaining little bit of time, what does it look like when an institution is making the right changes?
Oh, man, it looks like you're in a room or you're at a table and you're not the only one who looks like you there. I think it's so important to not just have, you know, what sometimes are referred to as token hires or diversity hires, that we really have to bring clusters of people in, and something I've been a huge support of, because I think it's difficult when you get hired at a job and you are the only woman there, or the only woman of color there, or the only person of color there. It can be extremely difficult. But when we show our students that we're invested in not just hiring one and not just having an only, but having so many people at the table to represent the diversity that the school themselves boasts so proudly of, you know, I think that's a big deal. So I've always felt intensely supported at Wellesley College, but I also think that I teach, you know, somewhat an anomaly. I'm at a women's college. I'm at a college where, you know, our president is a Black woman. Our dean of students is a Black woman. Our dean of admissions is a Black woman. So I kind of feel like I'm at Spelman a little bit. But, you know, we value diversity at Wellesley, and equity and inclusion. And that makes me feel so good to be a part of that community. But I also realized that that is not the norm, and that is not the standard. It's so many other institutions, and I've experienced it there as well.
Wellesley Professor Kelly Carter Jackson, you can find a link to her essay on our website, radioboston.org. Professor Carter Jackson, thanks so much for sharing your thoughts with us today. It was good to hear from you.
Likewise. Thank you.
That's our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Jamie Bologna, Chris Siderick, Walter Wuthman, and Amanda Beeland. We had help from Ali Audette and Stephen Gelman. Marquise Neal is our engineer, our executive producer, Hitesh Hathi. I'm Tisiana Deering. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.